Safa, my 12-year-old daughter, is standing by the window at the end of the building looking out over the day. The Israelis dropped a bomb near the area and it blew open the window. The sniper saw her and he shot her immediately. She was bleeding and I called many times for an ambulance, but the ambulances couldn't get into the area because the Israelis were stopping them. So I started carrying her towards where the ambulances were. I held her in my arms while my wife waved a white flag. We walked close to the ambulances and then the Israelis began to fire over our heads. We tried to save her, but we couldn't do much. In the end, she said, "Let me die. There's nothing you can do." We watched her for the next 3 hours die. And that is the kind of story that is coming out every day from Gaza. It was a story detailing the death of a 12-year-old girl, Safa, who lives in Gaza, and it was published in The Age not 2 weeks ago, but just 1 week ago. And when you hear stories like that, when you hear the kind of stories of brutality, you really have to wonder what possible justification there could be by the Israeli government, by the United States, for the kind of systematic starvation and the kind of military carnage that we're seeing in Gaza and the rest of Palestine at the moment. Well, the justification thus far, apart from the kind of fairly facile justifications of self-defence, have actually been that the so-called terrorist organisation that so-called rules Gaza, and they never say that actually Hamas was democratically elected, that this organisation, Hamas, needs to be sent a clear message, back down or you will be crushed. And so since their election to the Palestinian Legislative Assembly in January of 2006, Hamas actually seems to be at the centre of a real maelstrom of Israeli violence and Palestinian resistance in the territories captured in the Israeli 1967 war. And given that Hamas was only actually formed in 1987, you really have to wonder what accounts for this kind of meteoric rise in popularity. Some conservative commentators suggest, and some right-wing politicians, and unfortunately even some on the left, suggest that the rise of Islamic resistance organisations like Hamas in Palestine or like Hezbollah in Lebanon are actually part of a more general turn away from rationality. They reflect a deep-seated hatred of the people of these regions towards freedom, towards democracy, towards the kind of wonderful way of life that we in the West have. But in fact, what I want to argue in this talk is that in actual fact, the kind of turn, the rise of popularity of these kind of organisations reflects entirely the opposite. It reflects a deep-seated and entirely rational frustration that many Palestinians actually have with their current situation and the kind of frustration and a desire for something better out of the kind of previously dominant leaderships that led the Palestinian resistance movement over the last 50 or 60 years. And so I want to argue today that actually to understand all of this situation in more detail, we need to look at the history of the Palestinian movement against Israeli brutality and occupation and actually at the political forces involved. So from the early period of national struggle, the dominant force in the Palestinian movement was the umbrella group, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or the PLO, as it's commonly known. And the PLO, this kind of umbrella group, was initially established in 1964. It was established not by Palestinian forces themselves, but by a series of Arab leaders who wanted some kind of organisation that they themselves could control, that they themselves could actually decide what would happen within the Palestinian movement. But since 1969, the leadership of this organisation was actually captured by another organisation, because as people have to remember, an umbrella group. And this organisation was the Palestinian Resistance Movement, or Fatah. Fatah remained the dominant force in Palestinian politics until the mid-1990s. And the reason that I'm going to give some history of Fatah and of a number of the other kind of Palestinian organisations is because I think to understand the rise of Hamas, you really have to understand the decline in popularity in the politics and the social base of organisations like Fatah. So Fatah, in many ways, is a classic national liberation organisation. It began its life amongst the Palestinian diaspora in Beirut and Jordan in 1958, and its leadership developed out of some of the disenfranchised middle classes and some of the big Palestinian capitalists. And here we just have to think, I don't know if many people know, of a figure like Yasser Arafat, who became the kind of emblematic figure associated with Fatah and with the PLO over the years. But Yasser Arafat actually was a self-made millionaire. He owned engineering companies right across the whole of the Middle East, and he was a very wealthy person. And much of Fatah's funding came from Palestinian bankers and merchants whose wealth had actually managed to survive and prosper after 1948, the war that actually established Israel, or what is commonly known across the Middle East as al-Nakba, or the catastrophe. So much of the rank and file of Fatah, as opposed to the kind of leadership, consisted of ex-peasant or urban poor who actually comprised the bulk of the camp Palestinians, or the Palestinians who were forced to flee after the 1948 war and live in absolute desperate and grinding poverty in refugee camps across the rest of the Middle East. But even though that was the rank and file, the leadership of this movement was dominated, as I said before, by Palestinian capitalists or the Palestinian bourgeoisie. And that kind of political dominance actually influenced Fatah's political program and tactics. So the fact that the organization's ultimate desire was the establishment of a Palestinian capitalist state that they could control and rule, and, you know, obviously what do capitalist states have? They have a ruling class, but they also have a working class. And, you know, so the Palestinian capitalists wanted their own working class that they could control and exploit. And because of that kind of ultimate endpoint, because of that ultimate desire, this meant that the leadership of Fatah never emphasised the development of working class struggle. And they never emphasised that kind of struggle because they were fearful of the kind of development that that sort of activity could engender, that that kind of activity could actually create the kind of movement that could actually threaten their own class position. And it also meant that they actually saw the world much more, not just in terms of kind of class struggle, you know, across the region, but much more in military terms. So everything was kind of seen in terms of strengthening the kind of military struggle, you know, between the Palestinians and the Israeli state. The wealthier elements of Fatah also led the organization to develop a non-aggression pact, as they called it, with the Arab regimes across the region, which were often intensely despotic and which they hoped would actually aid them in their own desire to set up an independent Palestinian state. But while they kind of held all of these positions on the one hand, on the other hand, Fatah was also intensely influenced by the mood of the times. And because of that, they argued a series of positions which have become the kind of key positions for Palestinian liberation. They first of all argued that they needed the liberation of all of Palestine from the Jordan River to the sea. They refused to recognise the racist state of Israel to exist, and they demanded the right of return for the Palestinian refugees who were expelled in the 1948 war. But in the early 1970s, Fatah began to alter its demands. It declared that instead of the liberation of all of Palestine, that kind of hope, that kind of dream, they now declared it a utopia, and that the best that the Palestinian movement could possibly hope for was to gain control over some tiny little measly part of all of historic Palestine. And that the strategy to actually kind of get that goal, to get that kind of end point, was essentially negotiation with Israel and with imperialism. And so they would kind of negotiate on the one hand, and on the other hand, they would kind of be involved in armed struggle, this kind of attempt to back up or to kind of push these negotiations with Israel and with imperialism kind of one step further. And that kind of position, I think, is exemplified in a piece of theatre, which I would call it, Yasser Arafat actually engaged in the United Nations in, I think it was 1988, when he made a very famous speech. He went into the United Nations... 74, okay, much earlier. He went into the United Nations General Assembly and held aloft an olive branch in one hand and a Kalashnikov rifle in the other. How he managed to get it into the UN, it was a fantastic piece of theatre for him, but I think it also exemplifies that kind of political strategy that Fatah had, had launched. The early 1990s saw the beginning of a process known as the Oslo Accords, which was essentially an Israeli-Palestinian negotiation driven by Fatah and Israel. And this period actually saw the further selling of the Palestinians' historic desires really right up the river. 1993 saw the establishment of a Palestinian authority over the most densely populated sections of the occupied territories. But I would argue, actually, rather than representing the beginnings of the genuine liberation for the Palestinian masses, the Oslo years, in actual fact, were a significant step backwards. So in essence, what did we see during these kind of years of so-called peaceful negotiations as they were kind of touted by the world, this wonderful step forward, the Palestinians, the Israelis, they're all learning how to live together in wonderful harmony. But what was the realities, what were the facts on the ground during this period? Well, the first thing we saw was that this organisation, which historically led the Palestinian struggle, Fatah, actually now became, in essence, I think the best way to describe it, is subcontractors for the Israeli security forces. So Arafat struck a deal that in exchange for the establishment of a Palestinian authority, or the PA, over which Fatah could rule, Arafat actually made a commitment to Israel and to the US to police these territories for them. So they kind of became the subcontracted out security forces for Israel and for United States imperialism. And during this period of time, Fatah actually locked up and tortured and killed many, many genuine Palestinian militants. They killed and tortured people on the left. They killed and tortured many people who were genuinely fighting for a struggle for a free Palestine. Secondly, these years actually saw the development of a corrupt and bureaucratized Palestinian elite, an elite that was actually increasingly tied to Fatah. And there are two stories here that I think illustrate this very, very well. The first story is a story about Yasser Arafat's wife. And she was well known for dressing in beautiful kind of clothes, well known for being well decked out, I guess you'd kind of say. She was actually confronted by some Palestinian activists who said, "Where are you getting your clothes? Because inside the occupied territories, it's quite difficult to get nice things, as you can kind of imagine, in an occupied state. Are you going to Israel to shop? How dare you, go to Israel to buy your clothes?" And she responded with horror, "I would never go to Israel to buy my clothes. I only shop in Paris." So, it gives you a sense, and that's one story. Another story is about a guy called Mohammed Dahlan, who actually built a palace in Gaza. And this is in Gaza, with these kind of some of the highest levels of poverty and degradation anywhere in the world. He built a palace in Gaza, which was so ornate and so gilded with marble and gold and the like that it actually sunk into the sand. So, good, but, on the other hand, And so all of that kind of excess, all of that kind of, conspicuous consumption and wealth was happening at exactly the same time as the class divide within Gaza was actually growing bigger. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians live in absolutely dire poverty, and the United Nations actually estimates that at the moment over 80% of the population who live in Gaza live below the poverty line. That's 80% of the entire population of, I think, 1.5 million people. The Oslo years actually also saw the encroachment of Israeli settlements in Palestinian land. So the number of Jewish settlements, which are kind of dotted around the occupied territories, has actually trebled since the signing of Oslo in 1993. And this has been a very long-term and deliberate strategy by the Israeli state to actually try and parcel up, more and more of the occupied territories. Ariel Sharon actually described it as, I think, like a ham. You know how hams are kind of wrapped around when you buy them from the shop, if people buy them. I'm not seeing anyone nodding, but maybe people don't buy hams. But, they're kind of, parceled up, crisscrossed with all of these kind of territories, roads, roadblocks. It makes it utterly impossible for Palestinians to kind of get to work. You know, if you hear stories of people who live in Gaza, the reality of the situation is it takes some people 3 or 4 hours simply to get 1 or 2 kilometres to work. And that's the reality of life since Oslo. So the reality of the situation is, as I said before, that Oslo saw not the expansion of Palestinian control and power over their own lives, but actually the reduction of it. And those kind of failures, that kind of reality, actually led to an increasing disillusionment amongst Palestinians towards the so-called peace process, towards Fatah, and towards the existing political formations that existed at the time. And that kind of disillusionment exploded into active resistance for the second time in a period of kind of 20 years in the Second Intifada, or the Intifada of Stones, as it was known in the year 2000. And this was a genuine and intensely inspiring uprising of Palestinians in the occupied territories, but also significantly of some Palestinians who were living within the kind of Israeli borders as well. So since then, Fatah has been responsible for ongoing negotiations with none other than George Bush and the US administration, developing something very kind of euphemistically called the Roadmap to Peace. And we have to be very clear that this Roadmap to Peace is not a roadmap to peace. In actual fact, it's a roadmap to nowhere for Palestinians. This process is a total fraud, and even if the Democrats take over the White House, they intend on going along this kind of same roadmap to nowhere. There is no challenge from it anywhere inside either the Israeli ruling class or inside the American ruling class. And why is this process a total fraud? It's a total fraud because it involves attempting, or it's presenting itself as granting this kind of major and historic concession to Palestinians by granting them their own state. How lovely and generous of them. But in actual fact, what this stands for giving the Palestinians a tiny little unviable state with no control over their own borders, with no control over their own air, with no control over their own electricity, with no control over their own seaports. And so you've got that kind of tiny little mini state which has to kind of beg for everything right next to one of the most heavily militarized states in the entire world. And that so-called solution, and there's apparently a joke in Palestine which says the two-state solution is neither two states or a solution. In actual fact, it's a misnomer. All of that is essentially, a total farce and a total joke. So that's the situation. But while many people actually have felt totally betrayed, and understandably so, by Fatah's concessions and backdowns, I want to argue in this talk that actually their trajectory towards these kind of positions that they were taking were entirely predictable. The desire for the establishment of a new national state can situate these kind of national liberation movements at times in quite a hostile relationship to world capitalism. But at other times, this can seem more palatable to kind of world capitalism, and therefore these organisations are more than prepared to cut deals with the existing order, to cut deals with imperialism, to cut deals with the old ruling classes to actually get what they want. And I think if people need any more examples of this, we've been talking a lot over the weekend about the African National Congress and the kind of situation and the history of South Africa. Well, I think there there are some real parallels to be made between Fatah and between the African National Congress and the kind of situation that we've ended up with in South Africa at the moment. So everyone's feeling a bit depressed, and understandably so. But, I think it kind of raises the question at this point in time, was there ever any kind of genuine left alternative to that kind of dismal history of concessions, of betrayal, of increasing poverty, of increasing class differentiation? Well, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, this kind of umbrella group, also covered a number of secular left organizations. Organizations which declared themselves influenced by Marxism, but were in reality Maoist or Stalinist. And these were groups like the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And these organizations, while they actually managed to reach some size and influence in the Palestinian working class in the 1970s and the early 1980s, they were never actually able to challenge the dominance of Fatah. And I guess the question kind of comes, well, why? Well, there are kind of different peculiarities to each one. There are different histories, different kind of trajectories that each of them went on. But I think if I went into a lot more detail about them, I think I'd pretty much just end up sounding like a scene from The Life of Brian. So I'm not going to do that. But, what I'm going to go through is just some of the kind of more general trends of both of these organisations that led them to a situation where they're essentially written out of the picture, largely. The first problem with these organisations was their adherence to the ideologies of Stalinism. Both organisations were at times under the orders of Moscow, and so in that sense they actually, rather than serving the interests of the Palestinian working classes or the Arab masses of the region, they rather served the interests, the geopolitical interests of the ruling class in Russia. The second problem was that during struggles for national liberation, Stalinist organisations have often argued, and there's a long history of this again in South Africa, we have to look at the role of the South African Communist Party, but these organisations have often argued that there are other class forces which can actually substitute for the working class in these kind of struggles, and these organisations, these classes, need to lead the movement for the liberation of Palestine. And this led the fronts, as they're known, to emphasise the guerrilla struggle of a minority of people as the kind of strategy for the liberation of Palestine. And then the third problem with them was that they both, while at times kind of trying to vie and, jostle for more space within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, never actually were prepared to challenge for leadership of that movement, always on the basis that the working class, the left, needed to find some kind of accommodation with, these kind of bourgeois forces because, after all, we're all in this kind of national struggle together. We shouldn't kind of put off these other kind of forces. We need to stand arms linked with these kind of people who are building gilded palaces that sink into the sand, who have absolutely no interests, the same as the Palestinian working classes and poor. We need to stand alongside these people and kind of fight together with them. So those kind of politics actually led to the marginalisation of the left from the scene. And that is a tragic, tragic history. And that is a history that we're actually still paying for today. So we're about halfway through the talk. We've only just got to Hamas. So that's a good sign. So we're kind of going well. Hamas's origins lie in the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, a group which was established in 1946. And the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood was a branch of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, which was a bourgeois Islamist organisation which had branches all across the Middle East. But up until the First Intifada in 1987, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood actually abstained from the Palestinian resistance movement. And it concentrated instead on Islamic consciousness raising, doing good works, doing charity kind of around the region. And because of that kind of abstentionism from the struggle and because of their often quite conservative social agenda, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood was, in essence, the preferred organisation of Israel and the United States. They preferred them over the kind of the left and over the secular organisations like Fatah. But the beginning of the First Intifada saw a real shift in emphasis of the organization, with its leadership mainly embodied in a man called Sheikh Yassin, who maybe people have heard of. He was a paraplegic who, incidentally, was murdered on the street by an Israeli helicopter gunship in 2004. And this is a very familiar story, but people like him actually recognized that the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood would be totally marginalized from the scene unless they actually started to engage more in some of the active resistance to Israeli aggression. So the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood established in 1987 an organization called the Islamic Resistance Organization, or using the Arabic acronym Hamas. And that also means zeal, apparently. Apparently it has some kind of Hebrew connotations, which means like fear and run away or something like that. I'm not entirely sure, but, it sounds plausible. And so that kind of organization was established in 1987. So during the First Intifada, Hamas threw itself into the struggle and began to grow in size and influence. Their combination of Islamic charity, teaching, and determined resistance actually started to gain them quite a lot of popularity during this time. And this was added on to the fact that the failure of Oslo and the increasingly obvious corruption of the Fatah leaders led to Hamas winning control of the Palestinian Legislative Council in 2006. And I think we really have to say that that kind of victory was an incredibly kind of significant historic shift in terms of the Palestinian resistance movement. This shift, while earlier, as I said before, Hamas had been the preferred organization of Israel and the United States at this point in time, because Israel and, and the United States had developed quite a cozy kind of little relationship with Fatah, this was not welcomed one iota by Western imperialism in Israel, who immediately launched an all-out offensive against Hamas. And at this point in time, they actually tried to basically kill off all of the leadership of the Palestinian movement. They actually locked up almost every single, or when they could get their hands on them, locked up almost every single elected representative of, the Palestinian, of Hamas, to the extent that one of the first cabinet meetings that the new Hamas government had to have was actually in prison. They also, as I said before, tried to kill off most of the leadership of Hamas, and the Israeli Interior Minister actually said of Ismail Haniyeh, who was the democratically elected Prime Minister, he actually said publicly that this man was a legitimate target for Israeli assassination. He also quite famously said, "We must take the neighbourhood in Gaza in which he lives and wipe it off the map." So, what does, in essence, Hamas actually stand for? In 2006, Hamas released a lengthy self-definition, which I think gives you kind of a sense of the way that Hamas actually presents itself in relationship to the world and in relationship to the history of the Palestinian movement. And I just want to read it in a little bit of detail. Hamas is a Palestinian national liberation movement that struggles for the liberation of the Palestinian occupied territories and for the recognition of the legitimate rights of the Palestinians. Although it came into existence soon after the eruption of the First Palestinian Intifada, Hamas's roots extend much deeper in history. Hamas considers itself to be an extension of an old tradition that goes back to the early 20th century struggle against British and Zionist colonialism in Palestine. The fundamentals from which it derives its legitimacy are mirrored in the very name it chose for itself, Hamas. In the Islamic language, means that it derives its guiding principles from the doctrines and values of Islam. So you can see in those kind of statements that Hamas both puts itself kind of firmly in the Islamic tradition and in the Palestinian liberation tradition. And another kind of example of the fact that they put themselves in this kind of long tradition of Palestinian resistance is that their kind of martyrs brigade, or their kind of suicide, bombing brigade, their attacking brigade, is called the Al-Qassam Brigades. And Al-Qassam was actually one of the leaders of the Palestinian resistance movements in the 1920s. 1930s who was killed by the British. So Hamas calls on the morals and values of Islam, as I said before, you know, but they also kind of call on this long sort of tradition of Palestinian resistance. But for Marxists, there are a number of tensions and problems in the kind of picture that I've painted thus far. Well, for many in the West, the main problem with Hamas is its religion and its use of violence. I would have to say that Marxists hold absolutely no truck with those particular sorts of arguments. We recognise that actually the biggest terrorist on earth is the United States of America, and we take a firm stand against, you know, blanket anti-Muslim racism. Nonetheless, for Marxists, the real issue with Hamas is that they do not look to or consist of the social force that can actually genuinely challenge the United States and Israeli imperialism in the region, and that force is the working class. Hamas's leadership is actually primarily drawn from the middle class elements within the occupied territories. Its membership consists of merchants, business people and the rich, as well as the middle class and the poor. Outside of Palestine, rich Muslim business people in the Gulf countries represent the main source of Hamas's funding. And because of that kind of social base, Hamas actually tends to sympathise with the goals of the Palestinian capitalist class. So like Fatah, you know, before it, Hamas also believes in the necessity of an alliance between all classes in Palestinian society. And what does that mean in practice? In practice, that actually means that the Palestinian refugees, the Palestinian poor, the Palestinian working class, all of their interests must actually be subordinated to the Palestinian capitalists. And because class struggle is also not at the centre of Hamas's politics, the organisation does not hold an unambiguously hostile attitude towards the ruling classes of the Arab regimes. Regimes which, we have to be clear, are very well practised in the oppression and exploitation of their own working people. Indeed, Hamas actually seeks the approval and funding from these kind of organisations across the region, some of the most right-wing Islamic monarchies, some of the most right-wing governments in the region. And over the years, Hamas has actually taken funding from countries such as Iran and Saudi Arabia. So after the beginning of the siege of Gaza in particular, Hamas actually went kind of cap in hand to a number of these regimes asking for funds and actually offering some political concessions in exchange for that kind of funding. So in many ways, Hamas's attitude actually mirrors Fatah's position of non-interference in the affairs of Arab countries. And that kind of attitude actually means that Hamas cannot orient to the working masses of these Arab countries as genuine allies in the movement for the liberation of Palestine, as the masses of those countries actually have a serious interest in overthrowing the very forces that Hamas is actually trying to get on side with. So Hamas does not reject capitalism. It does not reject the exploitative and competitive class relationships that actually lie at the heart of imperialism, that lie at the heart, indeed, of the creation of Israel. Indeed, Hamas has never openly rejected free enterprise, subscribing to the belief within the circles of the Islamist movements that Islam encourages free enterprise. On economic policy, Hamas tends to accept the pro-market ideas that are pushed by the United States and its financial institutions, the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. And what's more, I think the fact that Hamas actually looks with admiration to regimes like Iran, regimes which actually tortures, kills, holds up their kind of working class militants and trade unionists and their organisations, I think actually says something about the organisation's attitude towards the working class. So, while it's the case that Hamas has actually grown in popularity because of their determination at this point in time to fight the Israeli state and their refusal to accept the continuing degradation of Palestinian life, I would argue that there's actually nothing in their social composition, nothing in their politics that would allow them to take a fundamentally different road from Fatah. So I would argue that what's actually needed in Palestine today is a genuine revolutionary working class force that actually develops something of the following strategy that I'm going to kind of conclude the talk with. So firstly, in the short term, the kind of struggles that were reignited during the Second Intifada need to continue. They need to continue, and they need to broaden out beyond the kind of, military strategy, the kind of strategy, the hopeless strategy, the strategy of desperation that is suicide bombing and the like. They need to develop trade union and community organisations on the ground. But in the longer term, though, we actually need to look beyond the boundaries of Palestine itself for a solution to the problem of Palestinian oppression. And I would argue that the only genuine solution to the kind of dilemma of the situation in Palestine today is the establishment of one genuinely democratic and secular state in historic Palestine in which Arabs, Christians, Jews, whoever wants to live there, can actually live together with equal rights. Indeed, I would argue that this is the only solution to the question of the right of return and the ownership of Jerusalem. And this solution can actually only be brought about by Arab working class struggle across the region, struggle which not only challenges Israeli occupation, but also United States imperial power and the strength of the Arab ruling classes, which are intensely despotic, as I've said before. The treatment of the Palestinians has been an issue close to the hearts of many hundreds of thousands of Arabs throughout the 20th century. And the treatment of the Palestinians, the kind of stories that I talked about at the start, the murder, the death, the degradation of life of the Palestinians has been an issue that has come to embody some of the most brutal realities of the 20th and 21st century imperialism. Palestinian resistance has in some ways been a kind of touchstone, a source of inspiration to masses across the region, and millions of people have mobilised in support time and time and time again in cities, in towns, in tiny little villages across the entire region, both in support of the First Intifada and then in support of the Second Intifada. The US occupation of Iraq, the murder of over a million Iraqis, the plundering of the country, this kind of situation has enraged many, many people across the world, not least of all the masses of the Middle East. So the possibility of the United States actually being defeated in Iraq would be welcomed with quite unrestrained joy across the region. And that kind of situation could actually spark off further movements of resistance across, across the Middle East. Indeed, I would argue that we actually have to look no further than the kind of beginnings of the dynamic that we saw in Pakistan recently, where we actually saw a US-backed dictator looking kind of increasingly shaky due to the kind of connection up of a number of the issues to do with the war and terror. So, but it's not just these kind of questions of, imperialism and, and I guess kind of military occupation that are fueling some of the sentiments across the Middle East. Across the region, there's also increasing class inequality. Millions of ordinary Arabs have seen a decline in their living standards as neoliberal policies have been introduced, and these kind of policies have birthed more and more resistance. The Egyptian working class, the largest of the Arab working classes, has endured 30 years of government attacks. Through cuts in social services and privatisation of the once massive public sector and lack of union or political rights. And those kind of attacks have actually led workers and peasants to fight back. In fact, in recent years, there's been an increasing number of serious industrial disputes, particularly involving textile workers, and in some instances involve workers actually taking over their own factories, in particular parts of Egypt. And it's that kind of force, I would argue, that could actually have the potential to topple hated US-backed dictators like Mubarak in Egypt. So I would actually argue that the key to Palestine in some ways could be found in places like Cairo. Nevertheless, and this is what I want to conclude with, the kind of spontaneous struggles of Arab workers will not actually be enough to defeat the might of Israel and of US imperialism. There needs to be a genuine strain of revolutionary socialist politics developed to inform such struggles. Otherwise, the same kind of, the kind of default position is that the same kind of nationalist, pro-capitalist politics will end up dominating these particular movements, no matter how brave, no matter how admirable these particular forces are. So a socialist alternative rooted in the day-to-day struggles of Arab workers against the oppression and corruption of their own regimes and in the kind of hour-to-hour struggles of the Palestinians must be built. And this is no easy task, given both the strength of US imperialism, the strength of the Israeli army, but also the dominance of organisations like Fatah and Hamas. But there is no real alternative except to try. The genuine liberation of historic Palestine, the capacity of people who spend their lives holding the keys to the doors of their homes that they were forced out of in 1948, the possibility of these people having the right to return to their homes, the possibility for real rights for workers and the oppressed masses across the region depends on the development of that kind of organisation.